Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. If you don't laugh, you'll cry, and I'd rather make you laugh, because if you don't, you'll die. And my very special guest today on the line, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is David Sarita. David, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. It's a little bit faint, but I can hear you.
How about I just turn the gain up on the mic? Is that better?
No, it's the same, but I can hear you.
Okay. Well, that's tolerable, I guess. Okay.
The question is, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Oh, good.
It's going
like
quite wonderful.
New Zealand accent.
Yes. See, the question is not whether or not you can hear me. It's whether or not you can understand the dialect. You know, somebody told me I had a funny accent once, and I thought I was funny because of my sharp wit, but I only just found out recently it's a speech impediment. Now, David, if you would indulge me and let us know a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, I do a lot of things, but I would say, you know, I grew up in the 1960s. I was born in 1961 in Canada, and our whole family moved to Berkeley during all the riots for the Vietnam War protests, and my dad is getting his PhD in psychology there, and started exploring the healing and super learning effects of deep relaxation and meditation at the University of California, Berkeley. So eventually, you know, his whole exploration of consciousness started wearing off on his four sons, and got us into doing yoga and meditation, you know, at the age of 13. But actually, when I was 7, walking home from elementary school, I saw a clear flying saucer. I mean, it was so clear. And I used to build model race cars. I used to build the Starship Enterprise models, you know, the Rebel model kits. And so I really knew aircraft and spacecraft, and I knew, you know, what I was looking at wasn't the Goodyear blimp. And people were in a pandemonium pointing up at this flying saucer. And, you know, when you see something like that at that age, I mean, in 1967 or 68, when that was, there's no such thing in my world as ufology. There's no such thing as, I mean, there wasn't any History Channel shows back then that were exploring the subject. It wasn't really even on TV. So it's quite something as an innocent, you know, kid to see something like that so close. And then in the following days, literally, my mom was in the middle of a divorce with my real father, and we moved into a new house in the Berkeley Hills with my new stepfather to be David Cooper, who was a science teacher. And so it was really, you know, it happened in this pivotal point of consciousness and science, and where I was going to be influenced by science from my new stepfather. And my experiences in that new house in the following week were that these beings from what we call the Pleiades, what they just showed me were these stars, the seven sisters, what we now call the seven sisters. They were showing me how their craft worked. They were showing me psychedelic like spinning in clockwise and counterclockwise on the same axis. They were completely human, but much bigger than we are, much taller, and different features. Their eyes are not the same as ours. And I really couldn't believe what was happening. In fact, one night, the babysitter, we had a babysitter in Berkeley because my mom was in this new romance, and we were, in the middle of the night, I was paralyzed. I went into what's known as sleep paralysis, and they were, it's not like abduction, like the gray aliens. They were completely human, but I was so uncomfortable with what was going on. I tried to scream, but I couldn't get control of my body. And it took a long, long time for me to say, okay, I don't know who you guys are and what this is all about, but this has got to stop. And I screamed so loud, and the babysitter came running down and grabbed me. And I just, from that point on, everything kind of stopped. But my whole life goes by, and it wasn't until the 1973-ish I saw on a TV station in Vancouver, Canada, where we moved again, back to be with our real father, Lynn Sarita. And, he was a hippie, you know, meditating, hanging out in Vancouver, going to nude beaches and things like that. And we were at this point raised with baseball. I was on baseball teams, and my stepfather was a science teacher, and bicycles and hot rods. So we go to live with our freaky psychologist dad again, and there's UFOs on the television, and it was the Billy Meyer story, how he was suddenly starting to see these flying saucers in Switzerland. And I said, oh my God, that's what I saw. And that was the same type of craft that was down low. Now, there were hundreds of witnesses that day who saw it, because it was down really low. And many, many years later, at a UFO convention, someone who worked at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, which sits right up on the hill above where we lived, said in 1972 they saw this guy approached me, and he worked at the lab that was known as the Space Lab. He said, we saw flying saucers out of the windows of the lab many times, and they were close. So I knew I had confirmation from another source, a scientific source, that the Berkeley area was being watched by these craft and these beings for a long time. And 72 is when Billy Meyer started having the ability to go public with his story in the early 70s. And there I was seeing it on TV, and I said, oh my God, you mean that there's other people who have seen these things? And so the door really opened. By the time I was 13, I was introduced to yoga and meditation and gurus from India by my father, and I started meditating every single day by the time I was 18. And, you know, I'm 52 today, and I've been meditating every day for over 33 years, doing all kinds of transpersonal, natural breathing techniques, deep relaxation meditation, brainwave studies. And it's utterly astounding. I mean, I can't even tell you how unbelievable it is to go on the path of meditation. No drugs, no plants. You know, I quit all those things in high school, which I tried very briefly for about 2 years. And had a lot of fun doing stuff like that, but, you know, and I'm really happy about marijuana trying to become legal, even though I'm not into it myself, because I get much higher meditating now at this point. So that's kind of where I came from. You know, that's
so do you get really hungry after you meditate as well? Do your your Dorito receptors?
You don't get the munchies. In fact, it's really funny because my wife and I, every night, okay, we want to watch this new latest movie flick, and I get so high. She's like, "Do you want to watch that movie?" And I'm so high from the meditating. I'm like, "No, I don't want to watch anything. This is too good." You know, you literally start to get that high. And there are numbers of gurus I've met. I'll name some of them. Like my first yogi that I ever met was a guy from India named Baba Haridas, who now lives in the mountains of Santa Cruz, California. And he's probably approaching 90 years old. And when I was 13 at this yoga retreat, you know, in the middle of the night, you know, I don't know what this stuff is. My dad was into all this. I was into baseball and hot rods. So, like, what is yoga and what is meditation? Well, in the middle of the night, I'm sleeping near the master's house in my tent. And my whole body, this energy, it's what they call kundalini, starts moving up my spine, but it's paralyzing me piece by piece. So my legs get paralyzed, then my hips are paralyzed, and I'm like, wow, what is this? It's almost kind of rumbling. And then all of a sudden, my arms are paralyzed, and I couldn't move them if I tried. This thing was so powerful, this force. And I thought, you know, just relax. I mean, I'm 13 years old, just relax. Let's see what happens. And I relax, and it actually is choking my neck. It goes up my neck, and I can't even think. And then all of a sudden, I'm in front of these three blinding beings of blue light. One is a woman with these beautiful jewels all over her third eye and her head, and a crown of jewels. And they're shining with all these psychedelic colors, and she's so beautiful. And there's a man next to her the same, and then there's this monkey god, you know, and I didn't know who the monkey god in India was. I mean, you know, I wasn't into this stuff. And they were shining with this blue light, and it was so powerful to look at them. I look at them and go, oh my God, they're like, they're gods. And they're standing in front of me. And so the next day, I go and I tell the master in front of a group of over 200, you know, yoga practitioners, and he laughs and he says, oh, that's Hanuman. And he has his disciple take me by the hand and go over and look at these Krishna paintings and you know, who this Hanuman guy was. And I go, oh, my God, that's who I met last night. And it turns out it's Hanuman, Rama, and Sita, these great Hindu gods. And I thought, how lucky could I have been? You know, people meditate, you know, they make prayers to them, and they have temples in India to Hanuman and Rama and Sita, which are incarnations of Krishna. And I'm like, I met them first right off the bat. So when I had that experience, it's kind of like, okay, this stuff is real. This stuff is fun. I want to know more. I want to start meditating more. But I still, you know, got influenced in early high school by, you know, pot and MDMA and cocaine I did once, and then I did mushrooms a lot. And I'm like, okay, this is fun. It makes me laugh. It gives me the munchies. And it actually helped. I would have to say the marijuana helped me cure my broken heart because, we lost our mom. Our mom sent us away to live with her dad, and she went to get a law degree, and we never saw her very much at all. And it ripped my heart to pieces, and I suffered from really serious levels of depression that were bordering on suicidal. And I became an extreme skier, a really crazy extreme skier in the 70s and 80s, and started jumping off, you know, huge cliffs and flying through moguls at, you know, 35 miles an hour. And I found that adrenaline-based highs were a good way for me to get beyond the pain by always staying in a high adrenaline state. And then I took up racing cycling in the summers in the city of Vancouver. You know, I was all into the super light frames, the Bob Jackson frame, and then going faster and faster and faster. And my brother Tim was skiing at over 120 miles an hour at Whistler, going down these avalanche chutes with his massive race skis. So we were all into adrenaline-based highs. And what I'm about to show you here is the difference between adrenaline-based highs and where meditation eventually goes, because it eventually goes into such cosmic proportions that it utterly dwarfs all of the highs that you get in adrenaline-based sports. So, you know, we're an adrenaline-based society. I mean, coffee, uppers, cocaine, speed, all these things to keep you so thrilled with super adrenaline so you can move super fast and work twice as hard as anybody ever worked in the 60s to pay off a house, and probably now about 100 times harder than anybody had to work back then to pay off a house. And then coffee, you know, just literally engulfs the world, so we're devouring rainforest to, like, buy the, you know, mega hectares to grow more and more coffee to keep everybody high on their adrenaline so they can do all this stuff and pay these banks these huge fictitious amounts of money that we invented that a house cost. So we went from the 1960s when, you know, my mom stayed at home and raised us, had plenty of time to be with us in the early days, to now most parents have to both be away. The kids don't have anybody watching them, and they're all getting ADD. They're not plugged into their heart chakras very deeply anymore because there's nobody really giving them love and nurturing because they got to work, you know, double jobs to pay for this number that we invented called a mortgage. So the adrenaline levels now in our culture are so ultra extreme. People are driving faster, driving crazier. You've got to burn. Like, remember in the 1950s and 60s, I remember when it was a big deal. Like, you know, you had your car for 20 years and you hit 100,000 miles. Now, you're going to hit 100,000 miles in 3 or 4 years. And what that does when you shift from relaxation, being in the heart chakra, blissing out in the 60s, everybody rebelled the government and they wanted free time. All the hippies said, you know, F off to you guys. We want to be free. We don't want to live in your society where we have to work like slaves. We want to have fun. So you went from that being a symbol, the number one symbol in a huge counterculture in America and Europe and Canada, to suddenly materialism and enormous increases in the cost of living to the point that we move away from bliss consciousness in the gurus. I mean, the gurus were coming, like the Maharishi was coming to America with the Beatles, and then you had Donovan you know, the great singer Donovan, who was really into the guru movement, and Ram Dass and Krishna Dass and all these guys that were hanging around with Neem Karoli Baba in India, they were bringing this concept of meditation to the West that said, hey, you know, it's really fun to drop acid, but it's way more fun to hang out with these gurus because they're transmitting this huge amount of consciousness and you get really high, like seriously blissed out when you really hang out with some of these heavyweight masters.
Well, David, we have a break coming. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, folks. My very special guest, David Sarita. Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I hope you get something really, really true from me and the guests that we have on this radio program. I suppose if we weren't telling you the truth, we'd probably be getting paid a shockingly large amount more money. My very special guest is David Sarita. David, are you currently in Canada?
Yeah, I'm back in Canada. We just left Sedona, where we were for 6 years, and we're up in Canada.
So previously you were Sarita in Sedona?
Yeah.
All right. I gotcha. Now, it's summertime in New Zealand here, so I hope that you're feeling the warmth all the way up there. It's not too cold, is it?
No, I got my heater on. We got a fireplace going here. We're sitting right on a lake in the Kootenays.
That sounds really majestic.
There's some hot springs nearby if I need to warm up. So
that sounds really majestic.
Yeah, it's really majestic. It's a beautiful, pristine place. And one of the reasons I moved here is because I've developed this new tuning transmitter technology, which we'll go into, and how to actually accelerate meditation and vibrate yourself, your energetic self, with the frequencies of another star system or another planet somewhere so you can astral project there. But where I was kind of going is, you know, how, I mean, everybody likes to get high naturally or whatever ways, and we have a million different ways that we try to do it. We all have different things that we really groove into and get us naturally high. For some of us, it's sports, and, you know, for me, it was for a long time, it was extreme skiing, and then I took up skydiving. I've got 300 skydives. I've jumped from 35,000 feet and done 300 miles an hour, you know, opening my parachute and all that stuff. And it's a lot of fun. Those things are fun. You know, what I'm saying about meditation and where it goes, it's not that you think, okay, those things are a waste of time. I look at those things as kind of a, you know, part of the path to getting over fear about being limited to just the body. And adrenaline, you know, energetic adrenaline, if you look at the chakra system in the body, you've got 7 energy centers in the body that correspond to glandular chemical centers in the body from the base of the spine. Then you have your sex center. Then you have your adrenaline-based center is the 3rd chakra. So when you, above the 3rd chakra is the heart chakra, then the throat chakra, then the 3rd eye, the inner eye, and then the super million lotus petal flower chakra on the crown at the top of the head, which is where the major ecstasy levels come in when that chakra lights up. So most of our culture is in the 3rd, you know, 1st to 3rd chakra, you know, sexual based highs that go into, you know, adrenaline, and when you're really deeply in love with somebody, you can really get blissed out in the heart chakra. But So that's kind of the extent of our culture. But when you look at deep mysticism and deep mystics, it took me a long time meditating every day, you know, doing deep breathing meditations, doing yoga, doing all kinds of pranayama, which are breath control exercises, you know, and some years go by where it's just kind of peaceful. You feel really peaceful after you meditate, but there's not any serious levels of ecstasy there. And it wasn't really until I started applying myself more. Like, I took my same extreme personality type that I had when I was an extreme skier and a skydiver and applied myself to meditating as much as 7 hours a day, sitting and holding this posture for an hour, taking a break and sitting and holding this posture. And then I went to these 10-day Buddhist retreats where you're meditating 10 hours a day for 10 days in a row, and that's when it really started to hit me how unbelievably high you can get, and it's long-lasting. It's not like something that just hits you for a few hours and goes away. I mean, some of these highs are so velvety, so cosmic, and so the bliss is so perfect that it's not like an adrenaline-based high where you eventually want to calm down because you're getting the jitters. You know,
could I ask?
I thought, you know, I am a thrill-seeker type personality, so if there's no really good high in this meditation stuff, I quit. You know, I don't want to do this and cross my legs my whole life and stare at my third eye just because someday I'm going to get supposed enlightenment. So I was approaching meditation.
I was going to ask you a question. If I may.
Yeah.
What is the difference between somebody who meditates for hours to get high and somebody who just shoots heroin and gets really high for hours?
Well, the difference in the quality of the high is enormously different. I mean, there's no sickness in the high you're going to get from meditation. There's no nausea. There's no throwing up like I got with mushrooms. There's no... The depth of the bliss and the ecstasy and the peace is so much deeper. And I've gotten this argument with so many people who are drug addicts, and they say, oh, no, you've never done this one, man. No, you haven't done this. And I'm like, you know what? I did enough to know that, and I can clearly see when I look at people who are on those type of highs, I look at them while they're on it, and I'm like, you're nowhere near what I'm talking about that's really possible through meditation, but it's okay. It's a lot of work to do the meditation. You know, you can't get a black belt in Kung Fu just sitting around and blowing circles in the air. You've got to apply yourself, and it takes about 7-8 years of meditating daily to get good at it. And there are a lot of techniques that don't work, like for Western people. They don't really work. And it wasn't until, actually, that I found my soulmate, my wife, Crystal, that I was able to really get so much love in the body that, because a lot of my experiences in the early days were out of body. You know, for example, and this is quite extreme. I mean, most of my practice became hardcore Buddhist Vipassana meditation, long, long hours of sitting. And in 1986, December 21st, which is solstice, you know, that's, you know, when the sun is going to start it ends its journey and it's about to start its new journey for a new year. December 22nd, I got this shaky feeling in my body. I was living in Vancouver, Canada. It was pouring rain, and I started to, like, shake. I thought I was coming apart at the seams. I didn't know what was wrong with me, and I went, whoa, man, go lie down. This is, like, there's something strange going on here. And I didn't know it was Kundalini at the time. I thought maybe I was having a nervous breakdown, but for no reason. And I lie down at 4:15 in the afternoon. Within minutes, I'm out of body in this perfectly clear crystal vision of an old man who's lying in the poorest of the most poor houses. He's got torn wallpaper on the walls, you know, pots and pans that are really cheap that he does his cooking with. And it's a shack, and there's two women in white robes praying over this dying man. And I approach him, and he gets up, and I thought, he's alive, and he's pale, and he says, do you want to see an angel? And I said, well, why, yes. And the second I said yes, there was this deafening. It's like thunder beyond a million times louder than earthly thunder. And the sky tore open and this blinding light starts shining down. And the most astounding voices of angels, the highest, most beautiful notes, ripping the vision to pieces. And there was so much power coming from this light. I collapsed on the ground, and these two women collapsed on the ground. And this old man was an enlightened master. And we are lying on the ground, and the sound is deafening of the angels. I mean, there's so many beautiful notes. It's like Handel's Messiah times a million. And I'm lying on the ground. There's no ecstasy. It's just pure, the fear of God and the angels and the power and the light. I'm shaking and shaking and shaking, and I'm aware of my body on the bed. And I'm becoming paralyzed piece by piece, just like I did when I was 13, you know, in the yoga retreat. And then it goes, my arms become paralyzed. I couldn't move them if I tried. And the sound in the room, I could have opened my eyes. It was deafening, the sound of the angels' voices. And it went up my neck, and I literally felt like someone was choking me. And instantly, when I relaxed into the neck, suddenly, it's like I was dead, and all I could hear was the deafening sound of angels, and nothing but the fear and the terror of God was in me. I didn't feel any bliss. And suddenly, there was an explosion of ecstasy that started in my belly that was like a supernova of ecstasy. It dwarfed all previous levels of ecstasy I'd ever known. And this ecstasy just exploded like a bomb, and I went flying up above the city of Vancouver, above the rain clouds. I went above the earth in this light, in this blinding ecstasy, and there was a glowing being off to my left, whom I guess was the angel, that, you know, the master that was dying in the bed. And then I saw hundreds of thousands of deceased souls in these silvery gray cocoons that were about the size of a human aura. They're like the shape of an egg. And it's interesting to note in near-death experiences, when people see they're going through the tunnel, they describe the walls as silvery gray. And inside of the cocoons, I could see movies. Like, you know, when you're thinking of an apple or an orange or some kind of fantasy is going on in your head, you're projecting it against your own little movie screen around your energy field. You're actually seeing the imagery with your eyes closed. And all of these deceased souls were dreaming what they had done in their life, but they didn't realize that none of it was real. They were in this kind of matrix where they were all only 2 or 3 inches apart, hundreds of thousands of them. And I was in this blinding ecstasy. I mean, the ecstasy levels were probably a million times greater than the best natural ecstasy in meditation or love or sex or anything I'd ever experienced on Earth. And it was sustained. It didn't stop. The ecstasy and the love didn't stop. And the angel singing was still deafening. So all that was happening, and then I came up to one of the eggs, and it started to shake and tremble. It was afraid, just like my body had to shake and tremble, and my ego, or, you know, the ego, the small self, had to crack open to get out into this super cosmic light. And the angel said, they're not ready. They're going to reincarnate. He said, they're not ready to live in the super light realm. They're too afraid, so they're just going to go through their life review process on their dreaming screens, and then they're going to learn the lessons that they needed to learn before they go into another incarnation, somewhere in the universe, not necessarily Earth. So then I sped through towards the center of the galaxy with this super light, and I approached a membrane that kind of looked like glass. And as I got close to the membrane, the ecstasy was so bright, it was crushing me. I was like, God, stop, This is too much ecstasy. I had no idea there was that much ecstasy in the universe. And I pierced the membrane and I went into the second heaven, which was instantly a million times more crystal clear than the first, instantly a million times more ecstasy and love and peace than the first heaven. And I was told there are millions of paradise planets suspended within this heaven, which is actually in our galaxy. And then I sped through that heaven, and I went to the third heaven, where everything multiplies another million times. And I said, oh, my God, I had no idea there was this much ecstasy in the universe, this much love, this much peace, this much beauty. And it doesn't stop for a second. you actually have to get used to living in that much love and ecstasy and bliss all day long. And then I went to the fourth, and when I went into the fourth, it was the end of having a human form. I became a giant star, and there was the ecstasy levels there begin to become unspeakably huge. I mean, they're so far beyond my wildest dreams in the fourth. There's no way to even speak about it. Any drug experience is like, you know, so cheap compared to this. There's nothing that can touch this. And then I went to the fifth and the sixth, which are utterly unimaginable, simply unimaginable, that is the human potential for enlightenment. And I saw the seventh, and the seventh was so massive. I said, God, you can't take me any further. I can't take this. It's too bright. There's too much. It's too overwhelming how much there is here. And then instantly, I had this desire that if I cross the seventh, I will not be able to come back and tell people that there really are seven heavens. There really are unimaginable dimensions to the kingdom of heaven and paradise, and I'll just die. My body will terminate on the bed. And I instantly woke up. All of the ecstasy was gone, like somebody turned out the brightest light in the universe. And the next day at 4:15, it all happened again. Now, when you have an experience like that, you come out of it and you come into the world and you go, oh my God, like we are living, I hate to say it, but in the most suffering, there's so much suffering here that it's like, how did that much light, how does it exist at the same time and we're in this? How is it possible that we don't get to experience? If everyone on the planet was lifted to the first level, there'd be no violence, there'd be no war, there'd be no lack of abundance anywhere.
Well, then the military-industrial complex wouldn't be able to make a living.
They would be so blissed out of their mind on love and ecstasy. The difficult thing in these realms is it's impossible to be violent.
Welcome back, everybody, and welcome back to my very special guest, David Sarita. David, I don't think you have shared your web address yet. Have you got one?
Yeah, my website is lightdreamtechnologies.com. That's lightdreamtechnologies.com is where my harmonic transmitters and my supercharged pendants are, and my movies are at voiceentertainment.net. I love that last song you put on, You Might As Well Be Walking on the Sun, because, you know, beings like Dante Alighieri, Emanuel Swedenborg, and many others, like Pythagoras, the great mathematician, experienced in meditation. Pythagoras traveled to the sun, and he found that it is inhabited by super-astral beings that used to live on Earth, and so are the rest of the nine planets on different frequency levels. All the nine planets have different beings living on them who have attained different levels of consciousness. And so, you know, we look out into the universe, and NASA looks out into the universe with this idea that there are going to be somebody else out there that's vibrating physically at the same frequency as us. And surprisingly, they can't find anybody anywhere. And they think, well, you know, we're physical, we're real, and if there's anybody else out there, we're going to bump into them. And this is where it gets really amazing. You know, for me, it's like, you know, I grew up in the 60s, followed all the Apollo missions, always wanted to be an astronaut. And the closest I got into physical space travel was skydiving, you know, jumping out of planes. And while it's a lot of fun, it doesn't compare to what eventually starts happening when, you know, I get deeper and deeper into the UFO phenomena. I'm lecturing all over the country on flying saucers and UFOs. I made a movie called Evidence, the Case for NASA UFOs, that was released in 2000. That kind of put me in a national radio spotlight when Dan Aykroyd did a cameo introduction to the movie. And I proved that the space shuttle was using cameras, video cameras, that could see very, very low, super weak levels of light. And that's where these unidentified flying objects seem to appear. Now, the UFO I saw in Berkeley in 1968, after about 20 minutes of everybody watching it, at least 30 or 40 people were just in that neighborhood alone in Albany, right next to Berkeley, it just blinked out. It went into another dimension. It physically didn't accelerate like an aircraft would. It just jumped dimensions. And that is a problem that has beckoned me since my childhood. I never, ever stopped thinking about the flying saucer incident. And I'm the kind of person who, you know, doesn't just take cheap modern science as the satisfactory answer to the UFO phenomena. You know, I kind of laugh at university-level physicists and scientists who, most of whom have never really built very much technology in their lifetimes. And a lot of them who have theories that are wonderful on paper, but don't really work very well in the real universe. And so, while the whole world seems to mostly trust them, that they would tell us if there were contact happening on this planet, having seen a flying saucer with my own eyes, not on a video camera, not on YouTube, there's a lot of fake footage on YouTube, when you have your own experiences, there's nothing more golden than that. And I started, you know, I started tree planting when I was 18, about 18 or 19 about, and I planted over 1 million trees, so I was doing my karma yoga work, and I actually loved tree planting. It was very peaceful, made me physically very, very strong, very powerful. Didn't make enough money to buy a house doing it or even to pay all my rent, but I really enjoyed doing it for all those years. I worked in landmine and bomb detection. I worked in nuclear fusion. I directed the Tesla Foundation in Los Angeles and spoke in Congress on non-radioactive nuclear energy and worked for a panel of brilliant physicists for years. So I kind of got into the science under the influence, I guess, of my stepfather, David Cooper, that science and spirituality were going to be, you know, the two doors that I would eventually try to merge. And then I started making movies because there were all these PhD university scientists and physicists that were working on the problem of consciousness at Princeton University, you know, like the Global Consciousness Project, headed by Dr. Roger Nelson at Princeton, and Gary Schwartz and many others. And I made this film called The Voice, my first film where I shift from flying saucers. I did a movie with Dan Aykroyd called Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, and then I went on to consciousness. And I really wanted to come back to consciousness because the reason SETI, using radio telescopes, couldn't make contact with another star system, seemed to me that the problem lies in our ability to sense using sensor technology was so limited and so dead that there was nothing more sensitive as a sensor than living DNA, living beings. And when aura cameras were invented and you could see that plants had auras and people had auras and animals and mammals had auras, it was very exciting to know that we weren't just chemistry. We were actually alive with light, and that light could be the answer. The light that emanated from physical living tissue could be the answer to receiving signals that were very, very valid, because where else where we, you know, and where we assemble consciousness ultimately, even now on the radio, it's You're listening to voices that are traveling at the speed of light through a network, a radio network or an internet network, but it's all assembling back into consciousness in your brain, in your heart, in your feelings. And the thing that consciousness has as an advantage as a sensor over electromagnetic sensors and, you know, strong and weak and gravitic sensors is that physics really only knows four or five major forces that it can sense. The consciousness has the ability to sense far more than that. Far more than that. And so what started to happen very quickly, you can Google this, is that scientists started to, in consciousness, like Fritz Albert Popp in Germany, a good physicist, standard physicist, proved that plants and humans and all living things that are energetic fields, our auras, were transmitting faster than light signals. Faster than the speed of light. And the only thing that could do it was living tissue. And that really excited me. I said, well, if living tissue and DNA, it turns out Fritz Albert Popp discovered that it was the DNA in the center of the cell that was actually the transmitter receiver for these faster light signals, that you could actually use it interfaced with a transistor, which is a piece of quartz crystal and layers of, you know, gold and metal, which amplifies all the signals in your computer. And then you have crystal oscillators that are very similar to transistors, but they're about tuning frequency. That if you interface that with DNA, you would have a far more advanced sensor. And that's what they're doing. You can Google DNA transistors and oscillators, and you'll find out that that's where artificial intelligence, that's where the new level of sensing is going. Because sensors that are, electronic sensors that are connected to living DNA have this super advantage in that they can receive and send faster than light signals. And the big giant radio telescopes, you know, albeit very impressive looking, like in the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, can't seem to find out that there's anybody else in the universe but us. And, you know, what a waste if we're the only ones here. And if no one's watching the universe, it isn't happening. Because if consciousness is not there to perceive it, all that beauty, all that color, all that ecstasy coming from the stars, then it's useless, because if there's nobody perceiving it, it isn't really even happening. And physics eventually started to go in the direction that they found when they did these explosions, these subatomic particle explosions in the early days. You know, Niels Bohr comes to Einstein and says, and Heisenberg comes to Einstein, and they say, this was at the, you know, I'm trying to remember the name of the conference, the conference, these great conferences that were convened every year in Europe. They said, it looks like the minds of the researchers are affecting the results of the experiments. And they said that this can't be happening, but it looks like it is. We have to remove the observer from the observed while we're taking the photos of the subatomic particles, because it's messing it up. And that really was a conundrum that really disturbed mainstream quantum physicists. In fact, even to this day, the most popular names in quantum physics will not admit that it's happening. But the best names in quantum physics in the early days knew it was happening. In fact, Einstein becomes so mystified by it, he literally believes, and so does Max Planck, who's really the godfather of the quantum movement and the protege mentor to Einstein. They really realized that, oh my God, the universe is alive and it's conscious.
I do think that we're entering into a new phase of discovery where we're capable of realizing that there are worlds within worlds within worlds, rings within rings, as they say. And some people try to deny that everything that they believe currently even exists at all. They've lost themselves, and as a result, they decide to deny anything else that contradicts their own disbelief in reality. We'll be right back after the break with David Sarita on the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
Summertime, living's easy, riding on the microphone.
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest is David Sarita. David, I wanted to ask you a question. Poignant question. Based upon these experiences that you've had with extraordinary bliss, ecstasy, that kind of thing, I've experienced lots of good times in my life, and I realize that once those good times are over, I'm often left with a sense of longing, perhaps even a sense of regret that those times are no longer with me, and I spend the rest of my time trying to get it back. Is this in any way familiar to you?
Well, yeah, it's harder with spiritual experiences like this because I can say, you know, the great times I've had with my friends, but the times, you know, the good times I've had skiing and skydiving, and, you know, think of the best sex and love and intimacy I've ever had in my life. And I think how there are these huge gaps in life where you don't connect into those places of normal human, you know, enjoyment, and how deep the longing is there. When I got back from the seventh heaven, the longing was so intense to be with God and to be in heaven that there was nothing I could do on earth that could compare to it. And it was actually later than that, the experience in 1987, that 86, the end of 86, that I took up skydiving, and I said, you know, I want to just take up skydiving because it'll increase the odds that I would just, you know, accidentally die, and I would get to go back. And I went to India. I asked, you know, I met with the Dalai Lama. I met with all these high Buddhist lamas, and I said, does anybody know where I was? Like, where was I in the universe? And it wasn't until I read this Buddhist Lankavatara Sutra that there was a clear description that the Buddha had described, even in the Dhammapada, these seven super states of consciousness, and that when he was born as Prince Siddhartha, it took him 400 lifetimes up to that point to perfect the samadhis 1 through 6, which are all the ones that I went through. The super luminous fields that I went through are the six levels of samadhi that precede nirvana. And nirvana starts at the seventh, and I had never crossed the seventh. I saw it, and it's so unimaginable even be in the sixth. But what the Buddha was saying in the sutra is samadhis 1 through 6 are just practice. They're not permanent states of consciousness, which is why you go into it and then it's gone. And then you long for it like crazy. You have to find out how to get back in it. And then you eventually find out. And, you know, now I can get into the first, second, and third on my own through meditation. You know, it's taken me years, mega years, to be able to do that. But I can't get anywhere near the sixth on my own. And to cross the seventh, there's a choice to go into extinction, because in the seventh, you literally disappear into super fields of levels of ecstasy that are, you're not a body, you're actually the whole universe. And that's why nirvana is called extinction, because you decide, I don't want to be a person anymore, I just want to merge with the totality of the universe. But at that point, Buddha says you have this choice to be a bodhisattva and come back and help others. And the bodhisattvas eventually become so powerful, they can create whole paradise realms with their minds, whole heaven realms, where disciples can live for thousands of years before they ever have to come back to a horrible place like this is becoming. And they eventually attain the eighth and the ninth. Well, in deep Christian mysticism, in the Nag Hammadi Library, there's a gospel called the Treatise on the Eighth and the Ninth, and the Eighth and the Ninth Heavens are exclusively for these super beings. You know, people eventually attain these super, super levels of compassion and want to house or create paradise in a heaven realm for other beings to live on. So, holy cow, I got my answer, and I said, well, now how do I get back into that state? And I meditated, and even though I could reach my formal levels of peace and kind of a smooth, velvety ecstasy, it's like, this isn't cutting it. I didn't stop meditating, but I was very disappointed that I couldn't do it. And I would cry. I remember one time crying on the floor in my room and you know, I just need to go back. I need to go back. And what happened is in 1994, that year, tree planting, the Canadian government decided to fine me because I owed $1,000 in back taxes. They wiped out about, you know, the equivalent of about $20,000 in today's money out of my bank account. I had no money, nowhere to live because of this huge unfair fine they gave me. And I ended up pitching a tent on my dad's ranch in Topanga, California that year. And in October, there were severe rainstorms. So I had just failed my business called the Green and Blue Corporation, where a partner and I tried to raise money for non-radioactive nuclear helium-3 fusion and oil spill cleanup technologies and hydrogen breakthroughs. This was in the late 80s we were doing this. No, the mid-80s. No, sorry, the late 80s and early 90s. And then, so 94, that company's broke. I have no money. And I'm living in my tent, and my dad's house is being renovated, and there's horses in the corral, and I'm sleeping next to the horses, really. And I got a BMW parked in the mud, and the rain is pouring down, and I pitched my tent in a gully, and a river of water starts pouring through the inside of my tent, and I start getting hypothermia, shaking and freezing to death. And I said, you know, I've had it. You know, this is it. I don't want to go in the house. I don't want to get warm. And my briefcase with all my, you know, all my income and all my business papers were floating in the water. Like, that's how much water was in my tent. And I was so cold, I left my body, and I remember seeing the auras around the cactuses and the plants in California. And I floated over to the oak tree where there was this giant crucifix that was made of granite and a baptismal pool underneath it, humming the sound of the angels. You could hear the angels coming from the water. And I fell in spirit into the pool of water, and all of my suffering was cleansed. You know, in Christianity, what you call the cleansing of the Holy Ghost. It cleans my whole spirit of all suffering, but there's still no ecstasy. And I float above the rain clouds, and the sun had not risen yet. You could see a glow in the horizon. I said, oh my God, I must be dead. I mean, I left my body, I'm up in the sky, like, what's going to happen? Like, holy cow, I froze to death. And there's no ecstasy, just feel just great. No pain, no emotional scarring, you know, it's all gone. And all of a sudden, millions of atoms of light, they're like tiny little stars the size of atoms, came from every direction, and this deafening, thunderous clap. And the atoms come rushing together, and they form the body of Christ in front of me. And, you know, I'm mostly Buddhist at this time, so this is a real shocker. And Jesus is standing there blazing like 1,000 of our suns, unimaginable levels of ecstasy. If I counted all the ecstasy on my journey 10 years before going through the seven heavens, it doesn't compare to what's coming from him. I can't look. He's too powerful. Oh, my God, I fall flat on my face. Oh, I look at him. Oh, my God, I can't believe the whole universe is coming from this one being. Oh, my, I've never met a being this powerful, this blinding. And he comes over to me, and I hold his feet, and I'm so blissed out. There's so much love. I'm crying my eyes out. And imagine crying from ecstasy, not from an emotional trauma or scarring. You're crying from too much ecstasy and too much love. And he's just pouring love on me, and he starts teaching me about the atom, the subatomic universe, quantum physics, you know, his true message, how the church destroyed his message, why the world's so corrupt. I mean, he's telling me all this stuff, and I look up at him, oh my God, it's like you're looking at the source of the power of all of the creation, and it's so devastating to think that one being contains the all. It doesn't seem possible. There's no way to describe experientially what it's like to look at one face, and the entire universe seems to be manifest from it. I mean, I'm just a little human. I mean, what do I know? But that's what it seems like. And so I can't look at him. Look at him for 1 second, look down. Look at him for 1 second, look down. And then the meeting ended, I go back into my body, and I was so happy, I'm alive, and I didn't even have the sniffles, and I'd previously been freezing to death, and I go running in the house, and I tell my dad, oh my God, I met Jesus. It was so incredible. He's like having his tea and with his wife, and, you know, I'm all covered in mud and wet, soaking wet, sit by the fire. And from that day, within 3 days, I could see the dead. I could see them instantly in the middle of the night. I'd feel this static electricity. I ended up building a yurt on a huge deck that I built on the hillside in Topanga.
Sorry, what's a yurt? What's a yurt?
A yurt is like, you can Google them, they're like really high-quality tents, basically.
All right.
It's a low-cost form of housing, and I built it myself and bought this $3,500 giant yurt with 9-foot ceilings, and I put a bed in there, made a room. And I lived like that for 5 years, and Christ would only visit me in between tree planting when I was in there. And he visited me 3 times there, and then the ghosts, like every other night, there were ghosts floating around. People were coming to see me on the astral plane, and I'm looking at them. And I'm going, oh my God, I'm really seeing this with my eyes open. And when Princess Diana died, she was... The next morning, the sun was up, and she was sitting on the edge of my bed with a thin strip of white light around her, and she's looking at me saying, I can't believe they killed me. And I'm like, what are you doing here? I mean, I had been working on landmines. Actually, at that point in my life, I was working for Department of Defense, and I was president of a company on the detection of buried landmines and hidden explosives for airport security, and I didn't want to leave my yurt. I liked living in that thing. I had my BMW, went to work, wore a suit and tie, and came home to the tent. And I saw her. I saw her so clearly. She didn't leave me for at least an hour and a half. She would not leave my side. And I saw hundreds of ghosts and spirit beings and star beings over the course of about 14 years. All the time. It was like living in a multi-dimensional universe. It was happening every other night. And there's so many different beings I've met. So many. I've seen ancient Native Indians. I've seen ancient Africans. One night there were 3 balls of light. One was white, one was fuchsia, and one was pinkish. No, purpley blue. And they were about the size of beach balls, and they're floating in front of me, and I'm looking at them. They're laughing. They're cracking jokes, right? Which I was like, this isn't funny. Like, I'm scared. I'm seeing these colored balls, and they're telling me they're Arcturians. And I'm like, I don't know what an Arcturian is. And I said, you guys better leave because, I'm really nervous. I don't know who you guys are. And I'm very into mystic practice. At that point in my life, I'm not into the New Age at all. I'm just into my Buddhist meditation, and I started doing a lot of Hail Marys and getting into Catholic mystic practices, and I'm like, this is a little freaky for me, these balls of light telling me they're Arcturians. Well, years later, there's a book called We the Arcturians by this woman called Norma Milanovic, and she describes the same 3 colors I saw. And it turns out there's a star in the Booth constellation called Arcturus. And then it turns out that in crop circles, and this is in William Gizecki's film, Crop Circle, The Quest for the Truth, you can see this kid on a tractor, and this ball of light the size of a beach ball in broad daylight comes up to him, and he falls asleep. It puts him in a trance, and he falls asleep, and they interviewed him after. And it turns out in all the crop circle movement, the balls of light identify themselves as Arcturians. And they're captured on cameras making the crop circles. And when the crop circle thing starts to get really big, the British military intervenes. They start making fake crop circles in the middle of the real ones. They start disrupting the field to make it look like, yeah, it's just these guys Doug and Dave, I think it is, who are with paddle boards running around. And they really did a smear job on what was really happening. Now, I saw these Arcturians myself with my eyes open. I've seen them several times. They've come back to visit me. And it's so mind-blowing to see this with your eyes open. In fact, one time when they came, I fell back asleep, tilted my head back down, and I immediately left my body and chased them. And they went up into the sky above the clouds above Malibu, California, and there were 100-mile-long motherships up there that they went into that were glowing with psychedelic color, blues and purple. And so you Google the star Arcturus and the Booth constellation, and you go, how the heck, I can't be making this stuff up. It's consistent with what other people know. It's then years and years later when I was making my film The Voice in Quantum Communication at voiceentertainment.net, you know, Gary Schwartz is this Harvard psychiatrist who started studying consciousness for years at the University of Arizona, Tucson, and he believes ET contact is real, and he gets this $300,000 infrared military camera that was brought to his attention because the military started seeing things on this camera that shouldn't be there, meaning balls of light. And they asked him what he thought it was. So he gets this psychic who channels ETs, and you can, I've seen the footage, and she calls in these ETs, and these little balls of light about the size of a beach ball come zipping and flying around her head like bees. You know, just one of them. And it's on camera. I've seen this, and it's never been released to the public. And this is what I mean about sensors and sensing technology. Physics doesn't acknowledge this stuff is real because they can't sense it, but they can. They're lying. They've developed the ability to interface super low, low-level, light-level cameras on the space shuttle and see these same balls of light flying in space and going, shooting up out of the Earth and going out into space.
Hey, David, it's funny you should mention that because somebody asked me what my beliefs are about aliens and other entities, and I said to her, look, if that everybody have the ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We rock steady, just like Black Betty. And my very special guest is David Sarita. Welcome back, sir. It's been quite pleasurable to just kind of introduce the segment and then just listen to you until the segment ends. It's quite absorbing.
Thanks. I missed the last thing you were saying. It broke up.
It was somebody asked me, I heard the feed outside that it kind of broke up a little bit. Somebody asked me last night, in fact, what my belief is about aliens. And I said to her, there are so many different accounts from different people who don't know each other all over the world, all saying the exact same thing. It's not possible, to my mind, for that to be a coincidence. It's not possible that they all imagined the same thing.
Yeah, it's not. See, when you have an experience like I had, for example, with the Arcturians, I never heard of the star Arcturus. I mean, people introduce me on radio shows, like, as a scientist, and I've studied science immensely, but in those years, I was absorbed in Buddhist and Christian-based meditation practices and meditating with monks and traveling to India, and I wasn't New Age at all. I actually wasn't into the New Age movement. I wasn't even following crop circles in the early days. And eventually, you know, what happens is, you know, when you Google something after you have experience, like I had an experience where Mary Magdalene was at the foot of my bed in Sedona, you know, when my wife and I were asleep in this deep, deep blue robe. This dark, it was about the color of sapphire, and it felt like a vacuum cleaner, her trying to pull me out of my body. And I was awake, and I'm seeing her, and I grabbed onto the sheets because I thought, you know, she's pulling me out of my body, and where is she going to take me? And, I was afraid, just like anybody would be when you're seeing a ghost. It is clear as not see-through, blurry, as clear as you can imagine. And Mary Magdalene was so powerful. And then she gave up trying to pull me out of my body, and she shows me how to decode the Mona Lisa painting. And I'm like, how could, you know, I made a movie out of it called Mona Lisa's Little Secret, and I thought, if I'm crazy and I'm schizophrenic, how would I get that? I mean, you know, watch that film, read the book that I wrote on it, and go, try to tell me that the math that she gave me is pulled right out of my hair, and I'm just out of my mind on this interpretation, because it's so flawless, and there's so much proof of what she showed me. And so every time I have a mystical experience, I test it somewhere. I got to find a scripture somewhere, like the Lankavatara Sutra, to describe the seven levels of superconsciousness, so I feel relaxed, like, you know, I'm not... There's no, for one, there's no way you can imagine in your imagination state, consciousness and levels of ecstasy that high. You just can't do it. There's no, like when people say, you know, you just imagined it, like how, you try it. You try and imagine billions and billions of suns of ecstasy and really feel it. You can't do it. There's no way you can do it. The imagination doesn't know how to do it. And so when I saw Christ, and then within days I'm seeing spirits like with my eyes open, I saw them for 14 years, and I've seen so many, and I remember so many of them, and I could write a book about it. When my wife was pregnant 3 years ago, when my daughter was born, when we were about 5 months into the pregnancy, every psychic was saying, it's a boy, it's a boy, so we picked out this name for a boy. And one night, I wake up because I can feel the energy when spirits come. I bolt out of bed, and there's a little girl glowing with light, and she's laughing her head off, and she's sitting next to the bed, and she's probably laughing because she knows we're going to have a girl. And all these psychics in Sedona were wrong. And so, and I look at her, and I go, oh my gosh, she looks quite a bit like my wife did when she was little, like the pictures. And I'm seeing her so clearly. It's not like I'm squinting my eyes and it's all fuzzy. I mean, it's super bright. Her aura was about as bright as brighter than the full moon by many times. And out of hundreds of ghosts I've seen, there's not very many aside from saints that are as bright as my daughter was when she was beside the bed. And so I told my wife, I said, you know, there's a little girl beside the bed and she's so bright. And she goes, well, that must be Alira, our second, you know, child. And she's just coming to, you know, be near our son, you know, because he's going to be born, you know, whatever. So I kind of put that thought away, and the day my daughter was born in 2010, I just cried my eyes out in ecstasy when she came out and I held her. I said, oh my God, it was you. You were trying to show me the whole time that it was you and you were a girl. And so this is the reason I'm telling you this is it's confirmation that this kind of stuff isn't schizophrenia. See, if it's schizophrenia, it doesn't add up anywhere. It's all whacked out. But it always adds up when I have these experiences. And eventually, you know, when I started seeing hundreds of ghosts, there were times when it was like, okay, I don't have any control of who is going to come and visit me and where they're from. And I realized from my scientific training that the language of the universe is really frequency. The planet Earth has a frequency measured by Tesla and Schumann of 7.83 hertz, or 7.83 waves a second. So I learned how to do the math to calculate the Earth's frequency, and I ended up getting NASA's data on the exact radius from satellite transmissions of all the nine planets' radiuses. I calculated the frequencies at the equator of all the nine planets in the solar system, and I went, oh my God, I can't believe what I'm seeing. If you look at the brain, and you think of a radio tuner, when you're tuning up and down the dial with the knob, you have a range of frequencies where all of your radio stations that you tune to are exist, you know, in the millions of hertz, megahertz frequency modulation, which is FM, and you say, okay, that's a bandwidth, and there's a lot of bandwidth below and above this bandwidth. When I looked at the frequencies of the nine planets, I said, they fit right inside of the five major bandwidths of human brainwaves. And I said, that cannot be a coincidence, that the frequency of Earth is the frequency where we all dream. It's theta, where everyone gets rapid eye movement and you start dreaming. And I thought, you know, we're all dreaming. Half of the planet's dreaming at pretty much the same time. And we're all dreaming at the frequency scale of our own planet. So I thought, what would happen if in deep meditation or dream time, you could dream on Jupiter or dream in the Pleiades star system? Because every planet is a different size and every star is a different size. They therefore have different frequencies. Well, I built a device called the Lightstream Technologies Transmitter, which is at lightstreamtechnologies.com, and I sell these devices for people who are interested in experimenting with them, to induce out-of-body experiences by tuning your energy field to the frequencies of the Pleiadian star system, the Sirius star system, Alpha Centauri, Vega, which was the star system in the movie Contact. Because NASA knows the radius of all these different stars, I can determine their frequencies. And I can harmonically scale those frequencies into the range of the human brain. This is really amazing stuff with Earth.
Is that kind of like champagne glasses with the width of them? They all emit a certain frequency based upon that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a good way of describing it. Because everything, if you have a glass bowl at different sizes and you ring it, the bigger the bowl, the lower the frequency, right? And then the smaller the bowl, you get the high ping sound. Well, with a sphere, a planet, at the equator, you get a nice low frequency. And as you scale up the sides of the circle and you get to the top, you get higher and higher frequencies. But most of the amplitude of the frequency is in the bandwidth of the equator. So I scaled all the frequencies up all the nine planets, and I did that for the Pleiadian star system, too. And I did this, like, you know, 4 years ago, even before my daughter was born. And I ended up transmitting my wife, who's a wonderful jazz singer. Her name is Crystal, and she's singing Fly Me to the Moon, you know, Frank Sinatra song, which I thought was a great song to send out through my Palladian harmonic transmitter. And I thought, let's just see if the quantum universe recognizes harmonics instead of radio frequencies. And I sent her song through the transmitter, and that night, now, I haven't seen a ghost in quite some time, because the last ghost I ever saw was when just before my daughter was born. So I don't see them anymore, except for when I use my technology, I have experiences with them. So it's very clear. And I ended up, so I send out the song, and that night I'm sleeping. And I think this is kind of funny, because I'm not really expecting anything to really happen. I hear this clear, mellow male voice that is so loving and calm, and it's audible. It's not like hearing something in your mind where your mind talks to itself. This is actually audible in a very, very deep sleep state. He says, congratulations, we received your message. Now what do you want to ask us? And I leap out of bed, and I'm like, oh my God, I heard that. I said, this, and he said, it works, you reached the Pleiades. Now I hadn't had any contact with the Pleiades since the 60s when I saw the flying saucers. It had been my whole life. I had basically given my brain, remember, the DNA in the middle of the cell is proven to send faster than light signals. So if I was sending a radio signal to the Pleiades, it would take 440 light years to get there, approximately. And what I was doing is saying, if I pulse my DNA with those frequencies, will my DNA jumpstart the frequencies and send them there faster than light? And it did. So I was so excited, and they said, now what do you want to ask us? And I had all these questions, you know, where have you been? Why did you appear to me when I was, you know, 7 or 8 years old, and you did me my whole life? And I'm recording these questions on a recording program on my computer, and I send them out through the transmitter. a day before my birthday, which is August 21st, as the Pleiades are rising on the horizon in Sedona. And I send out all these questions, and nothing happened that night, but two nights later, I was pulled right out of my psyche into a full contact experience with the Palladians, who answered all of my questions, whom I hadn't seen for decades. And I was so astounded at how this technology worked. Eventually, there's this movie in England called Resonance Beings of Frequency, which is all about cell phone tower pollution. But in the movie was this brilliant little clue for me. There's a Nobel Prize winner virologist named Luc Montagne, a French virologist who studies viruses. And he proves that DNA can read all frequencies of any wavelength. In fact, even when they pulsed a frequency close to the frequency of Earth, about 7 hertz, and the Earth is about 7.5 at the equator, he said it was reading the frequency and was acting like what's known in electronics as an inductor, transmitter, receiver. I went, oh my God, that explains it. It explains why if I put the frequency of the Pleiades star system in my DNA, it's reading those frequencies. And this guy won the Nobel Prize and proved it. So that means DNA is an inductor, receiver, transmitter electronically. And the human body emits light, according to Fritz Albert Popp in Germany, faster than the speed of light. So therefore, if you give it the harmonic frequency of a distant star system, and those frequencies don't exist anywhere on this planet, the quantum universe doesn't get confused, just like radio stations don't overlap each other. Anytime you have two frequencies generated by any type of crystal or nuclear resonance at any distance, you have, at the very least, light-speed communication. And if you include DNA in your sensor, you have faster-than-light communication. So I started doing this, and I started building these transmitters, and I started regularly having contact with a designated star system. I worked with the Pleiades for years, and I had so many experiences with them that it was like opening up a portal of communication between them and myself and my wife that had been missing since my childhood. And that answered the problem for me of, one, how in ancient religious cultures, like in the ancient Rig Veda, there was a Palladian god named Kritika. And the Rig Veda is probably the oldest religious manuscript on the planet right now that we know of. And what they would have you do is chant mantras, sound vibration, until you resonated with that vibration so perfectly, and that deity would eventually appear to you. But what I discovered is that if you magnetically transmit it, it's far deeper than sound, and sound waves are not very penetrating, and not only that, they're limited to 20 to 20,000 hertz, which is the scope of the audible spectrum for most.
David, I'm sorry, we're going to have to go to break. Like REM says, everybody hurts. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is the final segment right now with David Sarita. David, I would be honored if you would do two things for me. firstly, give out your websites, and secondly, if people are wishing to use these kind of communication technologies that you're talking about, that you've invented, where would they go? How would they do it? Are they able to construct it themselves? Are there blueprints or things of this nature?
Well, I generate all the math and the frequencies myself, and so I either sell the actual audible portion of the frequencies, because some people have experiences just listening to the audio, at lightstreamtechnologies.com, or they can just email me, David Sereda, S-E-R-E-D-A, at hotmail.com. That's David Sereda at hotmail.com, to get a brochure, PDF brochure, to look at it. But I've found, you know, from 33 years of meditating, I've never had this many extremely positive experiences on the astral plane. Prior to the technology and meditating, I had very few out-of-body experiences, like the one where I went through the seven heavens was, you know, years go by and I don't have experiences like that. Whereas now I've had so many experiences almost on a weekly basis using tuning my energy field to the frequency of a distant target. And when I realized that the human brain's frequencies all fit into the same frequencies that the nine planets generate, I realized, oh my God, well, that's induction. That's electrical induction. The transference of frequency from a transmitter to a receiver coil, and DNA is a receiver coil, that it makes perfect sense that we are tuned, and most likely our brainwaves are produced by the frequencies of our own planet. So we are cosmic beings because we're electrical. And in fact, my pendants that I sell at lightstreamtechnologies.com have already proven with aura camera photography to drastically improve the energy field of the body, which in a radio sense, you know, that's how transistors, you know, we went from tube amps to transistors because little pieces of quartz crystal used in transistors could amplify radio signals so you had better reception. And people who wear my pendants report being more psychic and telepathic with each other just wearing them. But when we did the aura camera test on multiple subjects in Sedona using my transmitter technology, we pulsed three people with the frequencies of the Great Pyramid of Egypt. And that will... It was so mind-blowing looking at the auras. They were so much brighter. In fact, they were so bright that other people in Sedona, you know, who sell healing technologies, got jealous because they said it can't be that bright. And I said, well, yes, it is. Look at the pictures. It's just, we lit up these, you know, women like a Christmas tree. And when you're that much brighter, you're obviously that much more broadcasting, receiving, efficient, so you're more likely to have the kind of experiences I'm talking about. So I started calculating more and more healing frequencies. Even in fact, we've used the devices for alternative healing frequencies and have amazing results coming in from people using it, from anywhere with people with cancer and tumors shrinking to arthritic pain going down. In fact, we had a child who broke her arm, and her arm did not work for 2 years. The nerves were completely dead. We pulsed the frequency of our sun, our own local star, and her arm was moving in 3 months. So it's amazing what frequency healing and frequency out-of-body projection targeted tuning frequencies can do spiritually. But this is where it gets difficult. There's a, because we're getting near the end, Robert Monroe at the Monroe Institute, very well known, was using sound, binaural beats, to induce out-of-body experiences. He did this test where they put him in a cage, a wired-up cage, sleeping area, and they ran no electricity through the wires, and he reported going out-of-body and going through the wire, no problem. But when they ran certain frequencies through the cage, he was trapped. The out-of-body master, Robert Monroe, could not get out. And this is in Claude Swanson's book, The Synchronized Universe. He's an MIT PhD who's appeared in many of my films. So what it proved is you could control the astral plane by transmitting certain frequencies into the environment, and people could not get out-of-body. And I found for years I was meditating, going into high states of ecstasy before I developed this technology, but I couldn't get out of my body very well. And I realized that, and like many conspiracy theorists do believe, that we are actually being mind-controlled by these huge satellites that surround our planet with frequencies to trap our consciousness into a limited, more subservient state of consciousness. And when you understand brain is an inductor, and it receives and reads frequencies indisputably by a Nobel Prize winner, you realize it's a very easy thing to do to control the electric, etheric, astral plane of the planet. In fact, I know many other good meditators whom, you know, 10, 20 years ago had no problem getting out of the Earth's astral plane and shooting out into space, and recently have encountered severe problems with getting out. That's when I realized that chemtrails were not only about weather modification. They were spraying in chemical tests done with air filters, quartz crystal dust, and certain metals, which is an oscillator. Those are the materials you need for an oscillator to amplify frequency transmissions. And I thought, oh my God, are they creating a vaporous antenna so they can use it to control the astral plane? Well, when I developed my devices, I was able to develop such a strong portal frequency in the house that at nighttime I had no problem getting out very, very frequently with these targeted star system frequencies. In fact, I've even used the frequencies of the nine planets in my sleeping meditation area, and I've been able to visit Jupiter and Saturn and have unbelievable experiences there. So we dream, remember, it's documented, we dream in theta, and theta frequencies are equal to the frequency range that you get at the equator of the Earth all the way up into North America and South America. That whole range is theta. And Venus is also in theta, whereas Mars is in alpha, which is what you need when you're awake to be very coherent, and Mars is right next door. And its frequencies reach us in a matter of seconds because it's so close to us. So it makes perfect sense when you understand that every planet is a different, like the glass bowl or the wine glass, they're producing different tonal frequencies. And I'm, you know, it's quite expensive to do this right now. I mean, my transmitters range from $1,200 to $1,800 now with all of the different destination frequencies, but we're going to make them into apps for people. It won't be as anywhere near as high of a quality experience, but at least you'll be able to listen to the tones through your iPhone so you can experience the sound. See, NASA recorded the sound of our sun. They actually recorded it. And when I listened to the sounds, it was low, medium, and high frequencies all in one, kind of pulsing. And the mantra OM in the Rig Veda comes from the sound of our sun. It means the sound of our sun. So when we chant OM, We're trying to resemble the sound that our star makes, and that's what it sounds like, but it has some very high notes in there, too. And that's because the frequencies get higher near the poles, and they get lower at the equator of the belly of the star. So I did that scaling to all of the different star systems, and you get a full-body sound in the Pleiades because, oh, it's just beautiful listening to the different tones of the different star systems just audibly. And people are going to be able to do this very inexpensively for $10 with the app that we're coming out with soon.
I do find that that's a great way because I think we're currently saturated by dirty electronic pollution and, as you say, it's preventing people from obtaining higher consciousness, astral travel, and so on and so forth. And now we're using that precise same system that's designed to keep us out of that realm with an app to bring us back into it. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, see, all these frequencies, like, you know, when you're in an apartment building and you go to click on your internet and you realize there's 100 other people's Wi-Fi signals sitting on top of your brain, and you have to select your channel for your Wi-Fi to get it transmitting. Well, all those Wi-Fi signals in a downtown cluster are all bombarding your brain. And the only way you can really get clear consciousness, because your brain is reading those frequencies, you know, this is proven, is to reinsert frequencies that are harmonic into your house. And speakers You know, sound speakers have a very limited frequency range. You know, good speakers, maybe 30 hertz to 20,000 hertz. But my transmitter will do ultra-low frequencies, way less than one wave a second, all the way through the audible, all the way up to super high frequencies. But I'm not transmitting any microwaves. So microwaves are the EMF spectrum that is harmful to the cells in the body. Your Wi-Fi is microwave. So we're now facing the problem that Wi-Fi and satellite communications and military mind control frequencies are dictating the scope of where your brain is allowed to go.
You know, it doesn't sound entirely dissimilar from the public education system. David, thank you so much for your time today. VoiceEntertainment.net, LightStreamTechnologies.com, email them today. We'll see you again.